Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. Coming up on this week's programme, when bacteria sabotage the body's ability to heal. If you are someone who lives with a persistent wound or ulcer, you might be interested in this particular one. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. As ever, we get to all of your comments at the end of the show. First up, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Shelley Brady from DCU's Insight Research Ireland Centre for Data Analytics and Dr. John Regan, who's a research fellow in the Department of Theoretical Physics at Maynooth University. You're both very welcome. Our first story is about vaccines.
Yeah, so there was two studies published this week, Jonathan, and they're challenging what we think we know about vaccines, in that maybe they're not just protecting us from specific diseases, but they might also be slowing down aging and that our thoughts could be making them more effective. So for anyone who's had the chickenpox, we're at risk for shingles. It's caused by a reactivation of the chickenpox virus. And shingles can occur at younger ages, but the risk is higher for those over 50. And therefore, the vaccination is generally provided to people of this age or older. And while the vaccine is designed to protect against the shingles, what researchers at the University of Southern California have discovered is that Americans aged 70 and older who received the shingles vaccine showed measurably slower biological aging compared to unvaccinated peers. Now, it's not about wrinkles or looking younger, but it's about biological aging. So how the body is changing over time, including how well organs and systems are working. And they measured this through things like they looked at inflammation, innate and adaptive immunity, and blood flow and neurodegeneration. And their theory is that by preventing shingles, the vaccine is reducing that kind of chronic low-level inflammation, which is well known to be a contributor to many age-related conditions like heart disease and cognitive decline. And they also think that the potential benefits could be persistent in that participants that received the vaccine 4 years or more prior to providing their blood samples in this research still exhibited slower overall biological aging on average versus the unvaccinated participants.
So, I mean, but like we have a chickenpox vaccine now, right? So do people in Ireland get the shingles vaccine?
Yeah, they do. Absolutely. Yeah, they do. But again, I suppose this is observational research. It's not proving that the vaccine slows aging. And no one's suggesting that the vaccine is an anti-aging treatment. But it does hint that protecting the immune system from this repeated stress might have a wider knock-on effect across the body.
Right. But it's funny, though, like we're starting to see these things. Once you get these large studies, how many people were involved in this one?
But there was 3,884 people, so it was quite big.
So like once we get to, you know, information, as data becomes really rich in this world, having a good idea of what effects might have and looking at correlations, you can really find that some things could be doing really exciting things that we never really realised. So that is quite exciting. Talk to us about the other study, though, because this was looking at positive thinking, which is often poo-pooed in science. But this study is quite interesting.
Yeah, so this study was published this week in Nature Medicine, and it was looking at how your mindset can affect what actually happens when you're vaccinated and how well your vaccine works. So it's not as big a study. So it was carried out at Yale University, and there were 85 healthy volunteers. And what happened was they activated a specific part of their brain known as the VTA, and that's linked to reward and positive expectations. And during this training, they knew how well they were doing because they were given real-time feedback in the form of scores. So when their brain activity rose, so did the line. So they could see what mental strategies were working best for them. So they were having positive expectations or imagining good things happening.
Right.
And after four training sessions, everyone got a hepatitis B vaccine. And it was shown that the people who had learned to maintain higher activity in the VTA produced significantly more antibodies in response to the vaccine. Now, again, way too early to draw conclusions about the degree of clinical relevance. Larger trials are definitely needed.
But the significance is doing a lot of heavy lifting here. How significant are we talking about?
It didn't actually say. It just said it was significant.
What?
But I would feel it could have been quite modest, but still defined as significant.
If it's significant in the what everybody who isn't a scientist means that word, it's a number, because if it was that, because those numbers are much bigger than what is clinically significant, which is often less impressive to a normal person, but impressive to a clinician or a scientist. If they haven't put the numbers on it, it makes me sound like it is clinically significant, but not what we would be impressed by.
And they were very clear. Look, they said positive thinking doesn't replace vaccines. It's an approach intended.
Good of them.
It's solely to complement any other, to enhance immune responsiveness to vaccine. But I guess what both of these pieces of research are suggesting is that vaccines don't necessarily operate in isolation, and they may be shaped by long-term immune stress, chronic inflammation, and even by that psychological state that we've just talked about.
I mean, you're talking about acute training that has an effect on antibodies created as a result of a vaccine. Like that's not a something to joke about. Even if it's small, that is absolutely a definite, it's a freebie. So very interesting research. Our second-ish story, John, has to do with the world's mountains.
Yeah, that's right. So this is, again, climate change. So the existential threat of our time. And this one, it parallels what we see in the Arctic. So the Arctic, what scientists have seen, is warming faster than the rest of the planet. Mm. So mountains, again, up high, lots of snow, and again, are showing very similar trends, actually. And this is not the drumlins out the back of your house now. This is like the Rockies, the Himalayas, the Alps, really, really large mountain ranges. And what they're seeing is, with larger statistical data sets, is that they are warming faster than the valleys below them. And this is not that surprising, really, because, again, it's that snowball effect, actually, again, with the snow. You melt some of that snow, there's less reflectivity, you're exposing the darker regions of the mountain that absorbs heat. That then melts more snow, which turns more of the moisture to rain. You get rain instead of snow, and it's really just a cataclysmic effect.
Yep.
Total disaster. And it's a disaster for a number of reasons. Like the Alps in Europe are known to be warming actually twice as fast as the actual European landmass. So it's a real problem. So a lot of, for example, the ski resorts, I know that's, real first world problem when you're with climate change, but the ski resorts are having real problems because the snow line is the line that kind of marks the end of where the snow is and where you're onto the land. So above the snow line, you have snow, and below the snow line, you should just be back to the grass.
Yeah.
And the snow line is rising. So the snow line now is at around 1,500 metres. And most of the actual mountain resorts are at 1,500 metres as well. Davos is at 1,500 metres.
Yeah.
And that's now becoming in danger of having no snow. And it's this mountain ecosystem that's just been transformed from climate change.
If you ever go to Chamonix, you can do what's called the Mer de Glace, which is basically this long, narrow ridge off Mont Blanc. It's an incredible ski. And it's tricky, like you have to be fairly good and go with a guide, but you can go down into the bowl of this glacier and you can go around to the bottom and then get a lift up back to Chamonix, right? There is, at the bottom, there's a big long staircase and it goes all the way back up. Mm. And on this staircase, you can see with your own eyes, marked on the rock, where the snow line has been. And if you ever wanted, if you ever doubted the severity of what we're talking about, that was, and I mean the last time I did, last time I was there was maybe 10 years ago. Hmm. That was shocking to me to see how 100 years ago it was 20 feet down. It's something very real to think about.
Yeah, and it's not like it's warming. And that's a really good analogy because the actual temperature differential is like 0.2 degrees per century. So it doesn't feel like a lot. But then when you go and see it. And I think for
that's
a lot
scary.
It's scary. But I think it can have a silver lining though, because a lot of people, rich people ski.
Yeah.
And that now affects them. And so maybe that will push their thinking. Orange Man himself.
That's very wishful thinking. They'll just make their own ski resorts with fake snow.
It's harder. It's harder when they're getting warmer. That's actually harder as well.
Shelley, our third story has to do with a deadly fungus and a meat source that I didn't realize was a meat source.
I know. So when we think about pandemics, I think we've been conditioned to think just about humans. But one of the most devastating global disease outbreaks in modern history has actually been happening quietly among frogs. and it's been spread as a result of the frog meat trade. So there's a fungus, it's known as the chytrid fungus, commonly called BD, and it attacks amphibian skin. So frogs need this to breathe and to regulate in water. And what it's done is caused population collapses across the globe, and some species have gone completely extinct. So scientists have been debating where one particular strain came from. And what they did to do this was really interesting. They examined over 2,000 preserved museum specimens, and these dated back to 1815, which I just thought was absolutely amazing. Mm. They were able to analyze fungal genetics from Brazilian bullfrog farms. They mapped 3,600 frog meat trade routes across 48 countries. So this was a massive piece of
work. Oh my God.
Huge.
Probably took AI about 15 minutes. I'm joking.
But the research settled it. Brazil was the source of this fungus, and the global trade in bullfrog meat is what spread it worldwide.
Can I ask, before we go any further, Shelley, how does one prepare a frog? Does one fry it? Does one boil it? Does one eat one raw?
I'm assuming they fry the... I don't know. I'm not going to pretend I even know.
Have you had a frog?
I've seen it eaten. It's like frog legs. So it comes out like chicken wings.
No, of course, frog legs. Isn't there frog legs? But I don't think they just eat the frog.
No, I've seen the frog legs, sorry.
No waste, yeah.
But it's like, you cook it like a chicken.
Right, okay. Welcome to dinner at your house. Sorry, Shelley, go on.
That's okay. So it was presented in wild Brazilian frogs, and they had multiple native species were infected in as early as 1916. And what happened was American bullfrogs were then introduced to Brazil in 1935 for farming. And then by the 1990s and 2000s, Brazil was exporting these bullfrogs back to the United States, which then shipped them to South Korea. And what was interesting was the frogs didn't need to be sick. They can carry the fungus without dying. So they were the perfect disease vectors. Once they were introduced into these new environments, the fungus jumped to local species that had no defense. So they literally hitched a ride in this trade network, and they spread from local Brazilian pathogens to a global killer.
Another great news story. Let's finish on something positive, shall we? An extraordinary witnessing of something we've never seen before in animals. Tool use in cows, John.
Yeah, so moving up the food chain in at least size. So Veronica, the cow, is Austrian, and she lives on an Austrian farm in the mountains. So real idyllic stuff, kind of Sound of Music stuff. Yeah. Mountains in the background, lakes in the foreground, beautiful. And this organic farmer keeps Veronica as a pet. So Veronica's not a... you know, whatever, a dairy cow.
Not a working cow.
Not a working cow, exactly, exactly, but a pet cow. And a few years ago, he noticed that Veronica was using tools, right? So she would pick up tools and start to use them for something.
Using tools, right?
And he took some videos of that and he sent it on to his family on WhatsApp, and he also put it on social media. And that eventually made its way to the University of Vienna. And the researchers there were interested in animal intelligence, and they latched onto this and they were intrigued, and they came to see Veronica the cow. And sure enough, they did some statistical tests on Veronica. So they would give her a broom, for example, and sure enough, she would use the bristled end to scratch her back, but then would flip around and use the broom handle end, I guess the softer, smoother end, to kind of like, you know, scratch her tummy or her belly and her udders and stuff. So this was seen as being multi-purpose use of the tool. So flexibility, and this is... a sign of high cognitive intelligence. And that had never been seen in cows before, or was extremely rare. Huh. It has been seen in horses, though, for example, have shown some of this previously. So it's a bit, it's not totally rare, but it's unusual.
Right. So, I mean, obviously we talk about crows all the time. If you want to go down a YouTube tunnel, crows' intelligence is mind-boggling, particularly given the size of their brain. It's just a fascinating. Just if you want to feel good, go find out about
crows. This is the New Caledonian crows, right?
They can count, they can barter, they can use a shop, they can figure out problems. They're really, really clever. But this cow, is that? It doesn't seem like and no offense to Veronica, but it didn't seem like massively impressive. But this is just not something that we've seen in cows before.
Yeah, exactly. I was exactly the same. It's not massively impressive. The big difference, though, between the crows and Veronica the cow is Veronica was just using this tool. The crows can manipulate like their environment to create tools. So that's another huge leap on the kind of evolutionary train. And primates, chimps can do the same. So there's still a big difference. I think what people... The big difference here is that with cows, it's was unexpected. They're domesticated animals. They're supposed to be unintelligent. And that's cultural as well. We don't want them to be intelligent because it's difficult to eat intelligently like animals.
Well, so, like, say that to the Spanish who eat octopus all the time. But I think this is a really interesting story. There's more to it in a way, but I think... We might get into that in another episode. But for now, Dr. John Regan from Maynooth University and from DCU, Dr. Shelley Brady, thank you so much. Now, your skin is supposed to heal itself, but often when you have a diabetic ulcer, that becomes hugely problematic. It can lead to amputation if not properly treated. And if it's not treated at all, it can lead to death. It's a massive problem across the world. Professor Kimberly Klein, who's a professor of microbiology and molecular medicine at the University of Geneva, is trying to understand it. Welcome to the program, Kimberly. Talk to us a little bit about wounds and why they heal in a healthy person.
Yeah, well, we have our body is really well tuned to fix these things. Our immune response is right there to jump in if our wounds get infected. And we have a very normal healing process. And I think most of us take that for granted. We get a wound, it heals up fine, and we don't even think about it. And as you say, you know, it's people, for instance, that have diabetes or other sorts of conditions where wound healing doesn't occur normally, that this becomes an enormous problem.
Take us through the step of how a wound zips back up after being being torn, so then that we can then talk about what goes wrong with people who have diabetic ulcers.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a very organized and stepwise process, as you allude to. Essentially, your immune system recognizes that there's some damage and it starts to do its thing, helping to repair damaged tissue. And this facilitates a process where new healthy tissue can come in and restore. And so it's very intricate, very organized, very precise and regulated, as you could imagine. But it really does end up looking like, as you say, it zips back up essentially if everything goes according to plan.
And so with people who have diabetic ulcers, these wounds just refuse to close. And it can be really, really sore and dangerous in this sort of circumstance. Talk to me about that. What's going on there, do we know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's where this is a big problem. So, for instance, in people with diabetes, there's a couple of things happening. One is that there's often circulatory issues at play. And so you can imagine the circulatory system is important for delivering, you know, immune cells to the site of wounds for infected, for example, or, you know, other things that are important for wound healing. And so if circulation is poor, then that wound is not getting what it needs to heal normally. That's one thing. And then secondarily, there's often immune system disorders happening at the same time. And so it's really a two-hit punch that makes these wounds difficult to treat in people with diabetes.
So there's something problematic with a bacteria that we find in chronic wounds. And this is, I suppose, a new finding. Talk to me a little bit about the bacteria that we often find in our gut. I'm not going to try and pronounce it, but why is this problematic?
Yeah, so the bacterium we're studying, it's called Enterococcus. And you're right, it's normally in our gut. It's part of our healthy, normal microbiome. It doesn't cause problems in the gut. But when it gets into the wounds, it can be a problem. This is not the only bacteria that can infect wounds. There's other bacteria that you've probably heard of, like Staphylococcus aureus. You know, some of these others also show up there. And one of the big questions has been, we know that infected wounds heal more poorly. And so the question really has been, why? and what about the bacteria are contributing to that poor healing. And we certainly know some of the things that contribute to that for some of these other bacterial species like staphylococci, but for the bacteria we study, enterococci, these are commonly found in wounds, and we had no idea why, if they were just a contaminant or if they were actually contributing to poor wound healing. And so in this study that we're talking about, we finally figured out how it is, at least one way, how the enterococci can impair wound healing.
And this is quite an unusual finding. It does this by essentially creating bleach.
Right, exactly. Exactly right. And so I should say that, you know, there are other bacteria that are known to do that, but these enterococci, this has never been known before, particularly in the context of these infections. And so this was a really big surprise for us to find that they make this bleach, as you say, and then that's really one of the driving forces that enables them to impair wound healing.
The first thought that I had was, surely bleach is actually good at killing other bacteria. is bleach not helpful, or what does bleach do to the healing process?
Yeah, so these are great questions. So actually, in this study, we figured out exactly how this bleach in the system is impairing wound healing, and it interacts with impairs a really specific process that occurs in our cells that's important for helping our cells repair themselves in times of damage. And so this bleach actually, it screws up that particular process. It's called the unfolded protein response. The detail doesn't matter, but that bleach itself is interfering with that process. So that's one point. And the other thing you mentioned is that can't bleach be killing other bacteria? And that's actually a really interesting implication of our work. And that is likely true. It, you know, there is a consortium of bacteria that are often found in infected wounds. And so we speculate, but we need to do the research to really understand this better. But we speculate that this bleach-producing enterococcus in wounds might affect which other organisms might be present with it, and maybe which ones can't survive in its presence.
I mean, are there potentially bacteria or microbes that are helping the wound healing process? I know, microbes are amazing at times. Is it possible that the mechanism of repair depends on microbes or bacteria that are being damaged by this process?
I guess that's theoretically possible. I think we don't understand enough about that process. Certainly there is this idea that there might be probiotic type bacteria, right, that can help the wound healing process. People are thinking about that in the context of bacteria that can sort of alter potentially the immune response within those wounds to promote that healing. And so people are certainly thinking about that. And you're right, it could be that enterococci in these wounds could either promote or prevent other organisms that could affect that wound healing process. That's certainly an interesting point.
This is a serious problem that, you know, wounds that don't heal over. 18.6 million people worldwide develop diabetic foot ulcers over a lifetime. As many as 1 in 3 people with diabetes might experience these foot ulcers. If you look at it, is your gut, and I'm not asking you to make a scientific prediction because obviously more research is required, but is your gut that if you can prevent this bacterial infection of wounds from this Enterococcus faecalis, do you think that it's possible that wound healing might be repaired and these people might actually be able to clear those infections?
Yeah, I think it's certainly a possibility. I mean, these infections are really complicated and there's many things at play. So I don't want to oversimplify the situation to say that if we get rid of one bacteria, that the problem is solved. I certainly don't think that. But it may be that in certain individuals, this might have a more pronounced deleterious effect. So that is possible. The other thing, you know, we're thinking about is that if we can neutralize this bleach that these bacteria make, which we've demonstrated in the lab works, if we can neutralize that, that might also help this wound healing process. One thing I think that's really important for your listeners to appreciate is that this is a really carefully tuned process. And so, you know, coming in and neutralizing bleach, for instance, at certain points of infection might be beneficial, but it might actually be harmful at different points in the healing process. So we have a lot more to understand about the timing of these things too. So we're optimistic that we can understand this better and sort of help clinicians think about treatments down the road.
How easy is it to target a bacteria like Enterococcus with an antibiotic, given the environment we're in where antibiotic resistance is rife? I mean, even if we find that actually, yes, it is this bacteria that's causing a problem, is it easy to get rid of Enterococcus? I'm getting used to saying it now. I messed it up.
You're doing well. It's Enterococcus. Yeah, you're doing great. That's a really great question. And the answer is it really depends. So resistance is a problem. Not all strains of Enterococcus are drug resistant. So many of them are sensitive to antibiotics. But the thing about these wound infections that make them more complicated as these bacteria live in biofilms. And what that means is the bacteria are living together in these really densely packed bacterial communities. It's little cities of bacteria or of bacteria. And these biofilms have a characteristic that they have increased antibiotic tolerance. Mm. So even if the bacteria themselves would be susceptible to an antibiotic, once they get together in these biofilm cities, they are more tolerant to antibiotics. It's also
logical that antibiotics won't necessarily work in this situation, because isn't that almost the first port of call for treating these foot ulcers that you get with diabetes? One of the usually blast people with antibiotics as well as part of the treatment. So that's not going to solve this problem.
Yeah, that's a very, very real problem. And the other aspect of that is, even if you can imagine putting antibiotics topically onto an infected wound, but if those little bacterial cities are resisting the antibiotics, that's one problem. But the other problem is if you take an oral antibiotic that's delivered via your circulation, and as we just discussed, circulatory problems can be at play in people with diabetes, there can be poor delivery of those antibiotics. The wound at the same time.
And of course, that leads to greater antibiotic resistance. So it's just like this cycle.
This is why it's such a big problem. Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing's easy on this program. You know, you ask all these questions, you think this should be easy. It's never easy. It's so great to speak with you. Really interesting research. And hopefully this can help us get one step closer to helping those people living with diabetic ulcers. Professor Kimberly Klein, from the University of Geneva. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, time to look back at some of your comments from last week. We were speaking to Dr. Penny Wozniakovic, who's a senior lecturer in space science at the University of Kent. She was talking about this massive gun that they have that they can use to shoot in a vacuum bits of debris at things to simulate what it's like when space junk hits other space junk. It's very, very cool. Listen back to that episode. Someone says, I wonder what the largest bit of space debris ever found. That's James. The largest discarded object was from the ISS, the International Space Station, and it was a 2.9-ton pallet of old batteries back in 2021. You wouldn't want that landed on you. We were also talking about Alzheimer's. We had Dr. Dylan Williams on. He's a research fellow in molecular and genetic epidemiology at UCL. Dean says, your interview is very interesting. However, I always debate how much people actually want to know about their future prospects of getting a disease or illness. I feel like many people would rather live in ignorance. My granny died from Alzheimer's. And many years ago on this program, we did a live event where I hired a psychologist and an ethicist and a geneticist to find out whether or not I carried the same gene as hers, which is a much increased risk of having Alzheimer's. Yeah, 30%. It's pretty heavy gene in terms of Alzheimer's. And I wanted to know. I absolutely wanted to know. And luckily, I don't have this particular gene. But it is a totally personal thing, because during that event, we heard people saying, I would absolutely hate to know. I just want to live my life and whatever happens, happens. And other people who said, if there was any chance of me having a catastrophic disease, I would totally change how I live my life. Kind of how I feel about it. You know, if you if these are the years that you're going to spend with your kids, you know, and you only have 10 years left before your brain, you know, starts to disintegrate. Now, of course, nothing is deterministic with genetics. I'm going down that silly rabbit hole. You don't know whether, just because you have one gene doesn't mean anything. 30% increase, it doesn't mean one third chance of getting Alzheimer's, of course. But the thought of, you know, of maybe living your life when you could have known and then finding out that you worked all your life so hard, you barely saw your kids. I mean, that's not something I would be happy with. Danielle says, if gene editing is a viable solution to reducing the likelihood of Alzheimer's developing, would researchers be able to get an informed consent from patients themselves to conduct that, or would it be from family members? Well, you know, obviously, ideally, you'd be doing this, if not in utero, not in adults, because then it becomes trickier. Like, I mean, if there was no ethics involved and you were completely sure the technology worked, you'd be and you were able to afford to do this. There's lots of what ifs. You could screen babies, or you could give babies maybe a vaccine, and that vaccine would be a vaccine for Alzheimer's. It would gene editing that would, you know, would work very different to a vaccine, but essentially could, you know, could theoretically diminish or disappear the idea of getting Alzheimer's. So you can't really get informed consent from babies, but if it was possible to do gene editing on this scale in an adult, that's a question that I think currently is very much in the air. It's not certainly possible now, but would it be possible in the future? Hard to know, because, you know, how much of the body do you have to rewire in terms of the DNA for this to stick? So I don't know, Danielle, but that's my best effort at an answer. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan producing, and thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.